if you're a narcissist and everything's going your way, then you can be as pleasant as anything. You can be, everything's fine. But when things are not going your way, now all the stuff comes out.
Welcome to Dangerous Dogma, the authority on questioning authority. I'm Brian Kaler, president of Word and Way. You can learn more about us at wordandway.org. In this episode, we're going to have a conversation with Dave Verhagen. He's the author of the new book, How White Evangelicals Think, The Psychology of White Conservative Christians. A psychologist with a PhD, he has served as the clinical director for mental health agencies, co-founded a large psychology practice, and has been an adjunct assistant professor of psychology at Vanderbilt University. So he brings a very unique perspective to the question of Christian nationalism. And so I'm excited to have this conversation with him to talk about what can we learn about religion and politics today from a psychologist. And I think you'll find some interesting answers in this conversation. And of course, if you're interested in learning more about Christian nationalism, you really need to subscribe to Word and Way's award-winning email newsletter, A Public Witness. Learn more, start reading, and subscribe today at publicwitness.wordandway.org. And now here's my conversation with Dave Verhagen on how white evangelicals think. Well, Dave, first of all, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
Yeah, I'm excited to have this conversation to talk about your new book, How White Evangelicals Think, The Psychology of White Conservative Christians. Before we dive into some of the ways that evangelicals think, let's set the stage in the background of you personally. And I think that's important for people to know a bit of your own story of how, where you came from and how you came interested in this topic.
I really appreciate that question because I think it does help frame what we're going to talk about. But I grew up in the evangelical church, and it is something that is still, that community and culture is still very important to me. That's how I met my wife, many of my business associates, many of my friends. I have a lot of connections still. And so it is, those are my roots. And I remember, you know, everything from going to Christian high school, being involved in campus ministry in college, volunteer staff in graduate school, being as part of a church postgraduate school and actually on the elder board, teaching at a evangelical seminary as an adjunct faculty, and so on. So I've been very immersed in this culture. And really what's happened, and I'm hopefully coming at this not from a place of being angry and hurt and resentful, but genuinely concerned and confused. And that has happened in the last, I will say, 6 to 8 years or so, where I have looked at what I grew up with and now look at what is being called evangelical and thinking they're worlds apart. The story that I opened the book with is that I had to speak at a conference in the early 90s, and I heard that it was at the Rocky Mount Retreat Center, something like that. And so this was before cell phones, before GPS. You get the big map and put it on the table. And I took the little highlighter and I said, okay, I was living in Chapel Hill, North Carolina at the time, and I map it out to Rocky Mount, North Carolina. I drive there and there's no Rocky Mount Retreat Center anywhere. It's in Rocky Mount, Virginia. And it's now 200 miles away and I have to book it to get there. And the analogy was, I thought I was going one place and I ended up somewhere else that had the exact same name. And that's how I feel about evangelicalism now, is like, I thought this was something, and now what this is a totally different place and name. And so for me, the questions were, has this been this way all along and I missed it? If it's changed, why? And now, why are evangelicals as a group, as a culture, the way that they are? Why are the people that are supposed to be the least fearful, seemingly the most fearful? Why are people who are supposed to be the most other-centered, seemingly very self-centered? Why are there all these culture wars? What's the deal with Christian nationalism? all of that. So the way that I work stuff out is I'm a psychologist, but I'm also a writer, an author. And so I write. And so I just started writing to myself. And some of it was confused and angry, and some of it was trying to sort it out. And in the middle of that, and this has been maybe 6 years ago, I was like, oh, I think I have something to offer from the perspective of psychology. Meaning, I think I can really dig into these questions as a psychologist. So I start posing questions to myself, like the ones I asked you earlier or put to you earlier, and then answering them not just with opinion, but what is research and what does psychology have to say that can give us some help in understanding what's happened?
Yeah, and I want to take a moment just to kind of talk a little bit about this, your psychology background and approach, because you do set that up in the book early on of explaining, you know, psychology and some of the ideas and some of the principles that you're bringing into this. And for those that maybe aren't as familiar with psychology, sometimes, you know, it has stereotypes and, you know, we have misconceptions about this field. What is it that you're actually doing in psychology?
What am I personally doing? Like, what is my work?
I mean, I think so. A little bit your psychological perspective that you're bringing. What is the field of psych? Let me phrase it this way. How is this book different because you are a psychologist coming from the field of psychology, as opposed to you mentioned the book, for instance, you know, a lot of people talking about, you know, Christian nationalism come from more of a historian perspective. What is it that you bring to this question from the field of psychology?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. Yeah. So to start with the last thing you said first, what we've noticed is that the conversation culturally, whether it's Twitter and social media or whether it's just in other forms of media, when we're trying to wrestle with these things of what's going on in the evangelical culture, have the voices that we're hearing are historians, like Kristen Dumas, John Fea, or sociologists like Sam Perry, Andrew Whitehead, and others, some in political science, Ryan Berg. And so you have these social sciences that are speaking to it, and psychology is largely absent from that. You don't have any legitimate psychology that at least I could find that's consistently talking about that. And this is just a field that's rich with begging for that. And so what psychologists offer is an understanding of how individuals think and behave, and how individuals also think and behave in a group, which is similar to sociology, but it's more about the internal workings. And so that's why the title is how white evangelicals think, right? It's the title evolved, but it's really about what's the inner workings of a person. And the field of psychology is very rich with research in looking at different people and groups of people and how they make the decisions they make, what motivates them, what drives them. In this book, I think there are between 700 and 800 citations. So it's not just what I'm bringing to this is not just, I think it's this. Now, obviously, being part of an evangelical culture for most of my life, several decades, informs how I understand the culture. But I'm really trying to back it up with, this is what we're finding about either people that are consider themselves evangelical or people that are conservative religious people in a broader sense. And it is another thing I need to say is the point of this is not conservative bad, liberal good at all. I think I tend to be pathologically moderate, and so I'm not one to go like, you know, I don't glom onto. I'm not a purist with conservative ideology. I'm not a liberal in that sense. I'm really trying to let the research lead me as much as possible.
I have to note that as you were mentioning, you know, historians and sociologists and political scientists, the, literally the five people you've mentioned we've had on the program. So I'm glad that we can add you to the list as well into the conversation.
I'm glad to. Yeah, I really am. And because that's, I think those people are doing fantastic work. The way they're thinking about things, the way they're trying to be even-handed, I think their work is fantastic. So I'm really grateful for them. But it's really surprising to me that there are not a lot of voices of psychology in this conversation, because it's really begging for that. And you know that there's always been this tension between psychology and evangelicalism. That has historically been there. And in fact, I had a guy years ago, he's an attorney, who we went to the same church, and he said, I want to have lunch with you. And I'm like, sure. And we'd had conversations where we talked about music and things, and I thought it was going to be like, and he basically, the lunch was, how can you be a Christian and a psychologist? Because being a psychology is antithetical to the Christian faith. And my answer to that was, no, it's not. He said, it's a worldview that is against the Christian faith. I think that's a misconception. I don't think psychology is inherently anti-Christian. I think, in fact, what we find is that when we look at research honestly, there are lots of aspects of being a person of faith that leads people to psychological and spiritual and relational health. That when the faith is healthy, those things are healthy. And when people are healthy, their faith tends to be healthier.
Well, let's talk about a couple of these psychological ideas that you bring into helping us think about what's happening in evangelicalism, particularly white conservative evangelicalism in the U.S. You write at one point in the book, white evangelicals in the U.S. have grown up in a subculture that says they are right and must be in charge to keep the country on the right track. At the same time, they have been largely isolated, ensconced in their churches and Christian schools and homeschools, cut off from those who are different, and told those outside the group are intent on destroying the country they love and are eager to persecute them and harm them. It's up to them to save America, but they can only do it if they retain their power and their rightful place. We could say they operate from an entitlement schema. We could also call it by another name, narcissism. And then particularly you go on to write about collective narcissism. So what is collective narcissism? And then how does this help us understand white evangelical culture today?
Man, that is a very full loaded question. I love it. So I'm going to dig into it. So let's talk about narcissism as a concept before we talk about collective narcissism as a way of leading to that. So all of us are on a continuum of narcissism. And some narcissism is what we call normal narcissism, right? It's just a need to focus on oneself, a need to get one's needs met. And then there's on that continuum, there's a point where it becomes not normal and becomes, in fact, for lack of a better word, pathological. And that's where a person becomes very entitled. They lose capacity for empathy. They see people as objects. They and within that, there's tremendous difficulty in interpersonal relationships. It causes them a great deal of problems, and it causes the people around them a great deal of problems. So we find, first of all, that all of us are along that continuum. What the research is finding, first of all, is that in the church, rates of individual narcissism, what I just described, are probably higher than in the general population. And particularly, and I hate to say this because many of my friends are in full-time ministry, and many of my friends are preachers, but among people who are pastors, the rates of diagnosable narcissistic personality disorder is much higher, we think. There are a couple of early studies that point in that direction. In one case, extraordinarily high. So that doesn't mean all pastors are narcissists. It doesn't mean all evangelicals are narcissists. It just means that it is the rates of that are probably higher. There's a dance of narcissism. And so there are narcissistic leaders and they're narcissistic followers. So narcissistic leaders are people that need the attention, they need the platform, they need people to kind of be looking at them and listening to them, and they want the power and control. a narcissistic follower is someone who wants someone to glom onto, that will keep them safe, that will pave the way for them. And so they tend to be a little more subtle in, it's not the kind of grandiose narcissist that we see with some forms, but it's still a form of narcissism. Okay, so that's individual narcissism. That's already there. What we're finding, and this is, I think, my biggest contribution to this conversation, is that there is a concept called collective narcissism. And collective narcissism is, the most succinct definition of it is, in-group love accompanied by out-group hate, meaning my group is special, and because you don't regard it as such, I hate you, or I am opposed to you, or you are my enemy. This was, believe it or not, first studied with something that was called football or soccer hooliganism. So in Europe, there would be fans of a particular team, let's say Manchester United, and they would brawl in the stands with the fans of the opposing team, especially if it was a known rivalry. And they would brawl in the parking lots, and they would, and it became such a thing that they had to change often how they admitted people and where they would sit and how they policed the parking lot. And there's a ton of research on that. And what they found is the underpinning of that is this idea of collective narcissism. You know, we are connected to this group, and this group is special, and it's not regarded as special. And so we're right to kind of fight and hate you. And then that, we see that in politics, we see that in nationalism. The punchline here is we have come to see that the evangelical subculture has become very, very rich in a bad way, very entrenched in collective narcissism, that this has become a subculture that is now characterized by collective narcissism, this idea that we are special, we are right, we deserve to be in power and control. And if you don't think so, that we are justified in coming at you and attacking you. And we will feel persecuted in that, even when the evidence might be thin that that's true, but we're going to feel persecuted, and we're going to feel very much like we're justified in this sort of fight against you. Obviously, that's antithetical to how most of us have come to understand the Christian faith, which is not at all about fighting of enemies and warring and trying to grab power and trying to assert ourselves as right or installing ourselves in positions of power. It's the opposite. But it now becomes justified because we believe, oh, we're right, we're special, and we're entitled to these things. And if you don't think so, then we can come at you.
And so I think people might start to see the connection to this next issue, but also you've already hinted at the idea of fear. But you write at one point in the book, you're talking about the idea that we all have this narrative from our personal traits, our life experiences, filters that impact the way we see view the world. These are the stories we tell ourselves, the way we make meaning of the world and our place in it. These stories have good guys and bad guys, heroes and villains, challenges and successes. White evangelicals have begun to tell themselves and each other a bad story, a narrative that is unhealthy, unwise, and unloving. It's a self-centered story rife with fear and hostility. It's a story that runs counter to the good story we are called to inhabit. But I particularly want to focus in on that idea of fear, because this is something you write quite a bit about in the book, this idea that evangelicals are fearful and they're telling this story. That they're supposed to be fearful of the world. And so what's happening here, and what impact does this have?
The research on fear is actually very rich, but also very complex. And the punchline I'll tell you before I get underneath it is that for the most part, what the research points to is that people who are more conservative, and now I'm not just talking about evangelicals, I'm talking about people who tend to be by personality and by worldview more conservative, tend to be more fearful. And there is thought that the tendency to be more fearful drives the desire to be more conservative, less so the other way around. And why is that? Well, you think about what is conservatism about, not intellectually and not philosophically, but it's really about trying to keep things the same and safe and routine, right? And that out of that produces a sense of safety and well-being. So people that have an underlying anxiety or fear are going to tend to gravitate toward wanting things to not change. So when they see big picture cultural changes happening, it feels very threatening and fearful for them. And so we do think that conservative people, by and large, tend to be more fearful in general. That also applies to people who are more conservative Christian. What's fascinating about this is that is true, but we do find that both liberals and conservatives tend to struggle with anxiety and fearfulness, but in different ways. They're afraid of different things. And the most fascinating piece of this to me is the group tells you what to be fearful of. The group tells you, and then you become fearful of that thing. So were evangelicals fearful of a worldwide pandemic that killed 1 million Americans? No, they were not. They would gather in big groups and take off and not wear masks, and they're not fearful of that at all. Are they fearful of immigrants and people that are different than them coming into the country and changing the social fabric of the country? Very much so. So it's not so much that evangelicals are fearful and others are not, but they are specifically fearful of things. And the things that they're fearful of are things that have to do with societal change and, for them, loss of power and control. They've been comfortable in a position culturally where they are the dominant shapers of culture. They are at the head of the table. And you don't have to be a genius to see where things are going culturally. And it freaks them out. And that's where the collective narcissism then starts to kick in. Is like, now that's sort of that begins to be our cover for, we don't want those things to change. And so we're kind of justified because we should be at the head of the table. We should be in power and control. And it gives us sort of cover for that.
And so then in some ways this could be related to the fear. There's other issues that you explore on issues of race, but fear definitely, you know, helps drive some of that. And you have multiple chapters on thinking about race and racism, both personal racism, systemic racism. So we won't unpack all of that. You know, people still need to buy the book. So we'll leave some stuff hidden and for surprises for them. But one of the things that I thought was particularly important as you were talking about race and racism was the blindness aspect. This idea of perhaps, you know, thinking, hey, we're doing really great and, you know, I'm not racist, but then, you know, actually adopting and holding these racist, you know, positions and so, or practices. So what's happening here with particularly this blindness to race for white evangelicals?
So I will tell you, if you want to get a white evangelical upset, you'll bring up the topic of race. It's just guaranteed.
I can attest to that from personal experience. I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, honestly, this is a surprise to me. When I became editor and president of Word and Way 6 years ago, the topic every year that I get the most negative feedback, angry letters, canceled subscriptions, is when we write about racism. And I did not expect that to be the topic, but it has been true every year.
I know. I think that's the surprise, is why is that so? So here's how I understand that and why I think that's so. I do want people to read my book. Please do. But I also want them to read, if they haven't read, Dr. Robert Jones's book, White Too Long.
Yes.
It's a James Baldwin quote. That's the title. And what I'm going to tell you is based on his research. And then I'm going to extend it just a little bit. So what he found, and he is talking about his background as a Baptist and having to kind of reckon with his background in the Southern Baptist tradition, and then what he's observing culturally with regard to race, and how race factors into his own story. And then he's also a researcher, and so he's collecting all this information, and he's coming up with some pretty hard conclusions. And it's very sobering, but it's very good. It's well worth reading. What he says is, if you ask white evangelicals about people of different races, how do you feel about Black people? And you give them a warmth scale, questions that ask about your emotional feelings towards someone of a different race, they rate off the chart, one of the highest groups of any, with warmth. Oh, I love Black people. I think, you know, I have African-American friends. I am very warm. So that's their experience of themselves, is I'm very warm toward Black people. I'm very open to them. I have good relationships with them. But then if you ask them to rate items on a racism index, and these would be questions, things like, do you think that African-American people have as many opportunities as most white people? Or do you think that the reason why there's a struggle in the African-American community is because they tend to be lazy and not work very hard, or whatever these kinds of questions would be? There are about 15 questions on there. They actually rate the highest of any group. So now we have this weird discrepancy or dichotomy where they're rating themselves as very warm toward Black people or persons of color, and yet they're also rating what we would consider to have racist beliefs or thoughts. Why is that? Well, there's a concept in psychology called the Dunning-Kruger effect. And the Dunning-Kruger effect, by the way, did you ever watch The Office, the TV show The Office?
I mean, I've seen some of it. I'm at least familiar with it.
Yeah. Yeah. So a lot of people are. I'm pretty sure that the company name, the paper company, Dunder Mifflin, is a play on Dunning-Kruger. I'm pretty sure that that's they use this idea, because it's all about a boss who thinks he's awesome, but is really a terrible boss and he's incompetent. It's the same idea. So here's what the Dunning-Kruger effect finds, is that the people who are the worst at things think that they are the best at things. That's the easy summary.
So therefore the boss in the show, right? So if we want to understand, I love that. That's a great helpful. Now we'll all remember the psychological yeah, concept. Right. You've given us a really great metaphor.
Yeah, that's it. So, you know, the boss who thinks he's got the little world's greatest boss coffee mug and he's drinking it on camera. He thinks he's awesome. And he just pontificates about his sort of philosophy of leadership and all this. And he's terrible. He's an awful boss. And the Dunning-Kruger effect finds, in almost any profession, in almost any task, the people that aren't very good at it actually rate themselves as being pretty awesome at it. And this applies to everything from being a driver, like the worst drivers rate themselves as among the best drivers. The worst teachers rate themselves as among the best teachers. We find the Dunning-Kruger effect kind of in all areas. This is really the Dunning-Kruger effect. It's that the people that have the most racist attitudes actually don't have the insight and the skill to understand that they don't, that they hold those views. And that in their view, they're fine. I love Black people and I'm not racist at all. And I bristle at the idea that someone would say that I hold racist ideas. That's what I think is happening, is that there's a certain blindness to their own attitudes, or they don't see that attitude as being in fact a racist attitude. Part of that is also fed by the fact that in evangelicalism, we tend to get into a bubble where our ideas get confirmed, and we don't allow outside ideas to really challenge that. We're not letting other voices come into that conversation and challenge that. And so we're just, you know, it's easy for us or people within evangelicalism to go, yeah, I mean, you know, I think it used to be a problem that the country was racist back in, you know, slavery days and post-slavery and even up into the, you know, 40s or whatever. But since then, we're in this post-racial society, and we're, you know, Black people have every much as opportunity as a white person, and there's no kind of systemic issues with, you know, it's easy to hold those views when you don't, when you're living in a subculture that says that that's right and is reinforced.
We'll be right back with the rest of this conversation. But first, I want to remind you that you should subscribe to Warden Way's award-winning e-newsletter, A Public Witness. It will help you make sense of the world of faith, culture, and politics. Learn more and subscribe today at publicwitness.wardenway.org. And now, back to our conversation.
And then, you know, there's another area that I wanted to unpack before we look at some kind of big picture questions. You write also write about evangelical embrace of conspiracy theories.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, QAnon's part of that. And, you know, what's happening here? Why are we, what does it mean that we're seeing white evangelical embrace of conspiracy theories, whether it's QAnon or other conspiracy theories?
This was the most weird part of the whole, all the questions that I was trying to answer, because when I was growing up in evangelical world, I was told that we believe in truth with a capital T, and that truth was preeminent, and that things were true or not true, and that the pursuit of truth was among the most important things. And now we have this evangelical subculture that is much more likely to embrace things that are demonstrably not true, and things that are so spun out that most reasonable people would not believe. If you really dug into the guts of QAnon and similar conspiracy theories, they are beyond outrageous, and they are demonstrably untrue. So why is that? That just feels so strange. Well, first, let's kind of tie it back to the earlier part of our conversation. In one sense, there's a motivation to do it because it serves their purpose, right? It's the purpose is we are going to favor people who fight for us and favor us. And so, you know, kind of the there's a there the people that, let's say, the liberals, the liberal elite, the people that we perceive as different from us, they're going to be the bad guys. And then the people that are, we perceive as our champions, the conservatives and so on, are going to be the good guys. And it's easy to believe a narrative that centers that and makes it easy for us to be like, okay, well, now we have justification for thinking these people are the bad guys, and we have reason to kind of glom onto these other people. So that's part of it. But the other part that I realized is that we have been primed as evangelicals and Christians in general to think in certain ways. And before I say this, I need to make this point clear. What I'm getting ready to say does not negate or discount Christian faith or belief. It's not saying that the things that Christians believe are, at least in terms of faith, are inherently wrong or suspect, but we're primed to think in a certain way, and the way that we're primed to think leads to certain thinking errors. And I won't name the, because it's a little technical, but there's certain like teleological thinking and not, you know, these kinds of thinking errors. But the idea that we're primed to think is that everything happens for a reason, and that everything that things that might just be things that occur in the world, that there must be an intelligent mind behind the thing that's happening. And so if something bad's happening in the world, well, there must be a motive for it. And there must be something that's hidden and unseen that's driving that. And so it becomes easier to believe, oh, there's this cabal of, you know, of Satan worshiping pedophiles who are all in the media and in politics, and it's all hidden from us. But if you have eyes to see, you can really see that. That's very congruent with how Christians have been conditioned to think about spiritual reality. And so it fits that way of thinking. And so in one sense, unfortunately, there is sort of an open door to these outrageous ways of thinking because Christians of all sorts, but particularly conservative Christians, have been primed to think there is a hidden reality, there's an intelligent mind at work, and that everything must be because of that. That then if you can look under it, there's sort of he who has eyes, let him see. And that also feeds the narcissism, right? The narcissism is, I'm special and I see things that you don't see. I understand things that you don't understand. And because of that, your rejection of this is only proof that you're blind to these realities and that I'm right.
Yeah, I think that's such a helpful idea and understanding because it really has been wild to see the embrace of conspiracy theories, you know, particularly like QAnon. Like it's one thing to, you know, to embrace like a, you know, we didn't land on the moon or, you know, theories about JFK. I mean, you know, right. There's, you know, or even some of the vaccine stuff, right. It's been like, you know, it's untrue. It's a problem that people who claim to be people of the truth are embracing ideas that are not true. But the QAnon theories, I mean, at the base of it, there's some theological, it's not just an issue of like factually inaccurate stuff. Like there is not even a basement in that pizza restaurant that somebody went to shoot up, right? Like factually inaccurate, but there's some weird theological spiritual with the Satan worshiping cabal. I mean, there's some, you know, embedded in this, some use of scripture by Q. And so, you know, that makes it even more bizarre. That even many white evangelicals, and you know, the research shows this, that evangelicals are embracing QAnon ideas at a higher level than the general public. And that to me is crazy when we think about the theological aspect of it, but yet you're explaining as to how this is happening. You know, I'm thinking at the point that we're talking, this will come out in a couple of weeks, but just recently I was at the Reawaken America tour event that's in Branson, and I guess it's heading your way. It's going to Nashville in January, the next stop. Yeah. And I mean, you know, on one hand, it's a political rally. It's very much MAGA. Trump's coming back to the White House and prophecies about that. You know, that's a big part of it. It's anti, you know, vaccine, not just COVID, but all of them. That's a big part of it. There's a lot of conspiracy theories related to all of those topics. But QAnon is also embraced in this movement as well. And then they're mixing it with prayers, scripture readings, Christian praise songs. I mean, if much of it time feels like you're in a white evangelical non-denominational megachurch, and then we're going to throw in all of these conspiracies about the election, about the vaccines, and about QAnon. And I mean, this is something that's really significant right now in our country among the white evangelical subculture.
It's deeply concerning. And there was a survey of pastors, and right at half of them, 49%, I think it was, said that they know people in their church that embrace QAnon ideas and suspicions. And that's, you think about that, that's people that they know of. A lot of this is underground. And I've certainly talked to many people in my personal life and even professionally as a psychologist. I've had a number of guys come in and say, my parents were, my dad was a deacon in the church. My mom was involved in women's Bible study. And they were, you know, the dinner conversations were about things related to faith and things related to, there's a lot of Jesus talk. Now it's a lot of QAnon talk. And it just feels weird. And what's happened? So people are finding within their own families, in evangelical families, that this, it's making their head spin because it's so different than how we came to understand evangelicalism back in the day, which was we're going to embrace the truth and try to sort the truth from the fiction. And now there's a greater embrace of fiction than any other group. And to be honest, just to make this succinct, it's because it serves their purpose. It completes the narrative that they're special and that they should be in power and control. And so it's a vehicle to work out this collective narcissism that we're talking about.
So as you know, as we have talked about these concepts, and there are many more in the book that you look at as well on, you know, how do evangelicals think? You know, one of the things you said really early in our conversation was that as you were asking yourself all these questions, you know, like, why are evangelicals doing this? And then also one of the questions you asked yourself was, well, have evangelicals always been like this? And I just wasn't noticing it, or have they changed? And I wanted to pose that question because I think that's a question a lot of people have been wrestling with over the, you've mentioned the 68-year period, right? I mean, while Donald Trump is referenced a few times in the book, it is not a book about him. But I think that his dominance, his support from evangelicals has a lot of people asking this question. What's wrong with evangelicalism? And did it change, or has it always been this way? And he exposed something within the movement.
I'm going to give you a direct answer, but the answer is going to be yes and no. It has changed and it has not. And so let me rock both of those sides back and forth. So I'm going to tell you a personal story, and I'm not going to name the school, and I'm not going to name the people associated with it. I don't have any business interest in calling that out. But in researching this book, I came across this idea of segregation academies. And segregation academies were private schools, particularly Christian schools in the South, that sprung up right after Brown versus Board of Education, either the year it was decided or the year it was implemented. And I began to go, oh no, because I thought about my Christian school experience. I lived in a city that was over a third, close to 40% Black, African American, and I had one Black kid in my school, actually him and his brother, so two in the entire high school. And I started going, oh no. I looked at the statements of history. The lower school was founded the year Brown versus Board of Education was decided. The upper school was founded the year that it was implemented. It was, in fact, a segregation academy. I had no idea. And so I'm in that bubble, and I'm very unaware. Within the school, never, and I mean never, was there that to my, there was never a chapel speaker, a teacher, an administrator that would make a racist comment. There was never any kind of overt racism. It was never present. But then you think, but I'm in a school that's been designed to keep white kids away from Black kids. And so in that sense, I was oblivious to it as a student. And in fact, I was oblivious to it until I was an adult and began to dig into this. So the answer, the threads of it, the roots of it, not just of racism, but of this need to be in positions of power and control, have been present. The difference has been, it's always worked for them. They've always been in power and control. So it's always been that Christians, not just conservative Christians, but Christians have been in positions of leadership in politics, leadership in organizations. It's been a white Christian person, particular man's game. Well, what's happened in later years is that the country's changing demographically. The country's changing in terms of how we're viewing some of these issues in some really good ways and in some very difficult ways. And now all the stuff that's there. So when, you know, it's if you're a narcissist and everything's going your way, then you can be as pleasant as anything. You can be, everything's fine. But when things are not going your way, now all the stuff comes out. So yes, what we're seeing now is different on a manifest level, on an overt level, because there are challenges that weren't there before. Before, it was easy to have a segregation academy or to have to be on a board that only had white people, or to, you name it. That was easy. It was never challenged. Now it's challenged, and here we go. So that's what we're really seeing, is we're seeing that all the stuff has been there. It was under the rock to start with. And now that there is significant cultural challenge to all of it, it brings out the worst. It brings out the bad stuff. So I hate to say that, because I wish it was just everything that my experience was growing up in the evangelical world, where everything seemed pretty cool and people seemed pretty generous and kind and other-centered, was all true. But I think the reality is that it was just because it was going their way.
And so my last question for you then is, thinking more forward, you've been helping us understand how we got here and how evangelicals are thinking today. What does it take, or can this cycle be broken? Is there hope? If you were able to sit, the white evangelical community down on your metaphorical couch, if you will, right, and tell them, here are the things you need to do.
Therapy as a session. Psychologist. Right. Yeah. My therapy with the entire evangelical culture.
Yeah, that's right. We're going to set them all down on your couch in one session. What would you tell us? Like, what are the first steps to recovery here?
So I'm going to answer the question, but I'm going to say this first. As I began getting into this book, I realized I'm going to approach this the way a psychologist approaches a problem. And psychologists approach problems first by assessment and then by intervention. So assessment is, let's really understand something well. We don't make assumptions. If a teenager comes in and he's smoking weed and acting out and not going to school and all that, we don't make the assumption of why that is. We have to figure it out. Maybe he's depressed. Maybe he's not depressed. Maybe he's gotten caught up in a group of friends that are all doing the same thing. We don't know. So we have to really assess it first. And then once we feel like we've got a really true, good understanding of it, then we intervene. The reason I say that is that the book is really about assessment. It's really about, let's understand this well. And so if I do write something later, it's going to be more to the point of your question of, what's the intervention? What does that look like? But I am going to answer the question, and that is, I think we have, for me, it was very disheartening to realize 80% of evangelicalism is what I'm describing, and 20% are the people like me who are going, what the heck's going on? And this feels different. And that felt very discouraging. But what I realized as a person of faith is that it's okay that it's the 20%. I'm not saying that we're right and they're wrong, but I'm saying that we don't have to be in a majority position, even within evangelicalism. And so within that minority needs to be faithful in the ways that we have historically thought of what faithfulness means, of being a person characterized by concern for the poor and the oppressed, by being generous, by being kind, by being hospitable, by loving people who are different than us, by loving people who are opposed to us. We need to be faithful in that way and act in line with that. So I think that's okay to realize within that the 80% doesn't have to, they probably will not change. I don't expect anybody in that 80% to read my book and go, you're right. I expect them to read it and go, I'm mad at you. But that's okay. And so I think the way I'm thinking about it now is, I want to think more about the 20% that see this in a different way, and for them to live more faithfully and have faithful lives. If the other folks are going to change, though, the only way they're going to change, the only way, is for them to be willing to give up their pursuit of power, need for control, the need to be dominant, and let go of this idea that either that they are persecuted or should never be persecuted, and release all of that and live in a more historically faithful way. I don't think a lot of that's going to happen, but I think that's the way forward. I think our better way forward, though, is to focus on the 20% within that want to live faithfully and to be a true faithful witness to historical Christian faith, and to not in angry, poke our finger in people's eyes kind of way, oppose Christian nationalism, which is ugly and is the outworking of all the stuff we're talking about, to actively oppose and work against racism in all its forms, to actively work to embrace people who are different, and even to actively work on loving our enemies. I think that's the only way forward.
Well, Dave, I really appreciate the fact that you've given us some time here on the program, but even more so for the book. It is a helpful guide in helping a lot of people make sense and understand what's going on in the world today and a little bit about how and why we got here, how white evangelicals think, the psychology of white conservative Christians. Thanks, Dave, for joining us on the program.
Thank you, Brian.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this episode of Dangerous Dogma. You can find more information and links in the show notes at dogma.wordandway.org. And don't forget to check out our website, wordandway.org, to learn more about our other offerings, including A Public Witness, a subscriber e-newsletter to help you make sense of faith, culture, and politics. If you've enjoyed this episode, I hope that you will share it with your friends on Facebook and head over to iTunes or your favorite podcast platform and write a positive review. It really will help more people to find the show. If you'd like to give to support this program, we greatly appreciate it. And all you have to do at wordandway.org is hit the donate button. And whatever you give there will help support the production of this podcast, as well as our website, monthly magazine, and other offerings. If you have any comments or feedback about this program, you can send those to me at bkaylor@wordandway.org. Thanks for listening.